America's at war. And I don't mean a war of armies in the Middle East or anywhere else in the world for that matter. The war America is involved in has been waged since the 1930s. Unfortunately, this war went largely unnoticed by the average American until recently, when the results of the strategies and methods of the enemies of America have become visible in cities and college campuses. This enemy has a name, cultural Marxism. Most Americans know it by another name, political correctness. One strategy employed by the haters of America and of our freedoms and liberties is to deceive and brainwash people with the subversive idea of social justice. Returning to the Soaring Eagle radio program to discuss the pseudo-ethics of social justice in economics, politics, and religion is author and researcher Patrick Wood. Stay tuned for that conversation next.
Remember that your failure to be informed does not make me a wacko.
The time has come, the walrus said. You talk of other things, of shoes and ships and sealing wax and cabbages and kings.
My mind doesn't work that way. I got this real moron thing I do. It's called thinking. And I'm not a very good American because I like to form my own opinions. I have certain rules I live by. My first rule, I don't believe anything the government tells me. And I don't take very seriously the media or the press in this country.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Hello, and welcome to Soaring Eagle Radio. Your host is Mike Spaulding. Get ready to be challenged and encouraged as you consider today's news and Mike's commentary from a biblical perspective. Now, let's join Mike.
Hi, folks. Thanks for joining us for this episode of Soaring Eagle Radio. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, and of course, you can listen to every episode on our website, SoaringEagleRadio.com. Patrick M. Wood is the editor of the August Forecast and the August Review. He's also the author of Technocracy Rising, the Trojan Horse of Global Transformation, and he is the editor-in-chief, Technocracy News, and that's on the web, www.technocracy.news. Pat, welcome to the Soaring Eagle Radio Show.
Great to be back. Thank you for having me back.
Well, thank you, Pat, for agreeing. Appreciate talking to you every time we have an opportunity. You recently posted an article on your website, Technocracy News, that caught my attention. And as I stated in the introduction to this episode, America's been under attack, I'll call it that, for at least, since the 1930s, by Marxists who created what they called the Institute for Social Research, more commonly known to people as the Frankfurt School. And this social research institute was really a think tank for communists puzzled by the lack of traction that Marxists' ideology was gaining. Two men, both Marxists to their core, Antonio Gramsci, who was an Italian, and George Lukács, who was a Hungarian, determined that Marxism had failed in Europe because the Judeo-Christian faith was so strong, and they decided that socialism would never win until Christianity was destroyed. And so that began the infamous long march through the institutions of America with the hidden agenda of uprooting any vestiges of family, of monogamy, of private property, patriotism, and most especially a belief in a personal creator God. Now, today, the most visible club that the cultural Marxists is, they're using is the rather, in my opinion, misplaced and misguided term, social justice. Now, you've written about that extensively. This latest article that you posted deals with that. And so my question as we get started today, Pat, is first of all, what is social justice? What's the history of it? And why has it become such a potent weapon of the progressive leftists?
Well, yeah, that's this is a term, a phrase that just gives different people different fuzzies. Sometimes, most of the time, it's warm fuzzies, because who can't get on the side of justice? You know, I mean,
right.
The Bible talks about justice, mm-hmm. and that's a good thing. Christians mm-hmm. should be concerned with God's justice. Yes. And to non-Christians, you know, to people like that are following the United Nations and mm-hmm. sustainable development, global warming, they use the term social justice in a wonderful way, too. Why, the 2030 agenda that was approved earlier this year promises to alleviate poverty everywhere. It promises to give jobs with dignity to everyone. Mm-hmm. And life is going to be wonderful, and it's all thanks to social justice.
Yes.
And so, you know, there's just a lot of confusion around this. And when I see a young person, sometimes a girl, walking down the street with a T-shirt on with a picture of Che Guevara
yes.
on the front or back,
yeah,
it just makes you want to, you know, grind your teeth, because they don't have a clue.
Mm-mm.
Of what they're doing. They really don't know.
Yeah, that's right.
And so people have lost the history of this concept of social justice, mm-hmm. and I think it's time that we bring that history out for people to examine. And some of them are going to sweat because they use the phrase all the time, and they're going to think, oh, my gosh, what have I been saying?
That's right.
I've been taking everybody down the rat hole for the last 5 years.
That's right.
But this is an interesting phrase. It goes back to the 1840s. And you'll find this probably a little, I don't know, not odd. Some people will find it odd. The first use of the term social justice was by a Jesuit priest by the name of Luigi Taparelli.
Mm-hmm.
He's a good Irish boy. And he talked about working for the common good, not for yourself, but for the common good. And this, of course, is what the United Nations is all about. You should deny your own personal selfish interests, and you should work for the common good of mankind. Whatever they tell you is for the common good, you should work for that.
Yes.
So he was writing about social justice, and then just a few years apart, we don't know if they knew each other, but Karl Marx started to write about social justice as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope someday I can find out definitively whether or not they knew each other in person, but they might have. It's possible.
It's possible, yeah.
But Karl Marx picked up social justice on pretty much the same terms, that mankind should work for the common good, for the collective, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And that personal rights and, you know, the personal good is really an outmoded concept. And that's what caused all the grief in the world anyway, with the classes. You have the rich and then everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So as Karl Marx was writing about it, it was just a concept for a long, long time. It, no big deal. But when social justice met politics, it started to really, the political scene, it started to really blow up.
Mm-hmm.
And the Bolshevik Revolution was probably the first major instance. Well, the French Revolution as well. But social justice was at the forefront of this whole thinking. And basically, here's what it means. Group A has a lot of stuff. Group B doesn't have a lot of the same stuff. Whatever stuff is, doesn't matter. But Group A has a bunch of that stuff, and Group B doesn't. So the social justice people go to Group B, and they say, look at Group A over there. They have a bunch of stuff. You don't.
Mm-hmm.
You work hard too, and you deserve some of their stuff. So you should go ask them for their, you know, they should give you some of your stuff, their stuff. So you should go ask them. And of course, Group B goes over and says, we demand that you give us some of your stuff. And Group A says, over my dead body, I worked for it, I earned it, it's mine.
Yeah.
And I don't want to give you any stuff. And so you see that a conflict develops at that point. And sooner or later, force enters into the picture because Group A will not give up its stuff and Group B will not give up its demands. So eventually, the antagonist says, I guess the only way you're going to get it is by force. And that's when the trouble starts.
Yes.
And that's what happened in all the revolutions of the last century that were centered around social justice. They all ended up in armed conflict. The citizens of the countries that this was played at had absolute carnage invoked on them. The Bolshevik Revolution, the Chinese Revolution, dictators like Pol Pot, Cambodia, National Socialism in Germany. If you add all these up, you're going to come up how many people died in those revolutions. You're going to come up somewhere around 150 to 160 million people.
Yeah.
That's half the population of our country. And that's at the hands, those are not external wars. Those are people that died at the hands of their own government. You know, the revolutionaries, in other words, that became their own government, like in the Bolshevik Revolution, for instance. And, you know, people today cannot conceive of this kind of carnage. That's half the population of our nation. Imagine one out of two people dying in our country.
Yeah.
We couldn't even find a place to bury the dead. It'd be so ugly.
Yeah.
And yet this is the history of social justice. And back in the 70s, late 60s, 70s, the two parallel tracks of social justice, one was the Marxist side and the other was the Catholic side. They met. The train tracks somehow converged and they sparked each other and they sparked what we know today as liberation theology.
Yes.
Yeah. And this swept Africa like a wildfire, swept South America like a wildfire. And again, carnage. I had some dealings in Southern Africa at the time that liberation theology was sweeping the countryside. And I remember in Mozambique in particular, when the Marxists took over there, they slaughtered all the intelligentsia.
Yes.
Every single one. If you had a degree of any kind, you just dragged out in the street, shot or cut up in little pieces. Yeah. That was it. No trial, nothing. Just killed everybody that knew anything.
Yes.
Same thing happened in Rhodesia, basically. That wasn't quite so bad, but it was really bad. And the sad thing in Rhodesia is I remember how peaceful, before the revolution there, how peaceful Rhodesia was and how well blacks and whites got along together. It was just incredible. From America, I was amazed. There are places I would never go in America. I could go anywhere in Rhodesia and feel completely safe. It was just amazing.
Yeah.
And people would help you out, whether you're black or white, rich or poor. They didn't care. They're just all having a great old time. But afterwards, of course, you know, you wouldn't walk the street for love nor money at night. You know, the sun goes down, you go in. Period. So anyway, liberation theology took off, and that was a mix of Marxism and Catholicism, and all based on social justice.
Yes.
All based on social justice. Why, in Rhodesia, they said, why, those white farmers, and Rhodesia was a British colony, by the way. Why, those white farmers have all the land. They have the farm equipment. Look what they do out there in that land. They work that land. They run those tractors. They harvest stuff and they sell stuff all over the world. And why, they're getting filthy, stinking rich. And don't you think we should have some of that? And yeah, you know, that's exactly what the rebels were told. You just need to go take it.
Yeah.
So they went. And they killed the farmers. They killed the white farmers. They took over or ran them off. They took over their property and their farms. And they went out there and squatted on the land. They didn't have a clue how to start a tractor, much less maintain it.
Mm-hmm.
they didn't know how to plant a crop.
Yeah.
They had much less harvest a crop.
Yeah.
So the farms immediately were destroyed. And while they're thinking somehow a miraculous golden goose is going to come along and lay an egg on their head, I don't know.
Yeah.
But nobody knew how to do anything. They just sat there and waited. And then nothing happened. Everything fell apart. All equipment, you know, rusted out. And the crops went, all the fields went to weeds and stuff. And they wondered, what happened?
Mm-hmm.
They yeah. never figured it out.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
It's liberation theology, mm-hmm. all in the name of social justice.
Yes.
So when the world is speaking about social justice today, everywhere, it's everywhere. It's on the lips of school children.
Yes.
It's on the lips of people in churches and mm-hmm. pastors of all things
yes.
around our country.
Yeah.
And not just Catholics, not just Episcopalians and Presbyterians and whoever, but even evangelical pastors.
Yes.
Maybe you should say
yeah.
formerly evangelical mm-hmm.
yeah,
pastors.
Yes. Yeah.
They're talking about social justice too. And then the United Nations. Oh my gosh, it's all over their website. You can't hardly read a page on their website that doesn't talk about social justice.
Yes.
And so this is a phrase that's on the lips of virtually everybody in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And what people don't realize is that while social justice was limited in scope in the last century, like we weren't involved in the Bolshevik Revolution. I suppose yeah. somebody might have felt sorry for those people who were getting killed over there. But, you know, there was millions and millions of people died. Under Hitler, there was millions of people died there. Americans didn't get too upset about that either, by the way. They didn't get too upset about China because, hey, we're America. You know, we're over here.
Yeah, right.
So those revolutions were localized in a sense. But now social justice is global. It's everywhere.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's the same context that all these dictators and evil people used over the period of time. And, you know, you have to sit back in your easy chair and ponder, when is it going to hit the fan? When Group A says, you can't have any more of my stuff, Group B.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
yeah.
we're putting our foot down.
Yeah.
And Group B finally figures it out. The only way I'm going to get it is by force. So here we go.
Yeah, that's right.
You know,
yeah.
out come the guns, the machetes, and the sharp knives, and
yes.
whatever else means of killing people.
Yeah, yeah. The historical sketch that you've drawn there for our listeners, Pat, got me thinking that social justice is really a sleight of hand. It's the phrase itself is a misnomer. It could very easily be called, instead of social justice, intentional social upheaval, because that's exactly yeah. what results from the application of this kind of thinking. And you touched on a couple of points that I want to make sure our listeners didn't miss. And they are intricately wrapped up in the concept of social justice as it's being applied today. And as you pointed out, globally, and that is the one of the very first tenets that you're going to hear about is called distribution or redistribution, and it's almost always focused on economics, on wealth, mm-hmm. on a redistribution of resources, as I think, as you said, from the haves to the have-nots. Equality is bantered about, and again, it's not used in a sense of fairness, but it's used in a totally different way. And of course, then you mentioned the common good. That's the icing on the cake that gets everybody to acquiesce to the social justice. And I call them cultists because they have got a religious fervor for the idea of social justice that really is a faith. It's a religion. So in your article, Patrick, you talk about the United Nations getting in line or being aligned with, I guess, the strategy of the social justice movement across the globe, I guess that's not a surprise, and it shouldn't be a surprise to people, but what are they hoping to gain by this?
Well, the United Nations is in the position it's in today because of the global elite putting them in that position. It didn't just evolve like out of, you know, some Big Bang theory or something. People think, oh, United Nations, man, is that an organization that got out of hand? No, it never got out of hand. It is what they intended it to be, and
yes,
it was purposely started to achieve an agenda.
Yeah.
And so when United Nations picked up the whole idea of sustainable development back in the mid-1980s, actually, it was at the hands of a member of the Trilateral Commission.
Hmm.
And I document this in my book very carefully.
Yeah.
But the Trilateral Commission was that group founded mm-hmm. back in 1973 by David Rockefeller and Zbigniew Brzezinski that promised to create a new international economic order.
Yes.
And that puzzled us back then. Honestly, I didn't know what that meant. I just thought, right, well, they're going to change the deck chairs on the Titanic or something. You know?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Just figure out some, yeah, other way, some other way to game the system. You know,
uh-huh.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But when I discovered technocracy, I fully understood what they meant by new international economic order. They meant something literally brand new. And as it turned out, historically speaking, there's never been an alternative economic system put down on paper outside of technocracy that was done in the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
And that was written up or created, modeled, whatever you want to call it, by prominent scientists and engineers, many of which were from Columbia University at the time in New York City. And they created technocracy to replace capitalism.
Yeah.
Because they thought capitalism was dead
mm-hmm.
back in the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm.
They were sure that capitalism was completely gone and dead, and that they and they alone were able to take over society and run it like a machine.
Yeah.
Scientifically speaking, like
yeah.
a machine.
Well, that Patrick, let me interrupt you just for a moment. It occurs to me, just in case, there's a very small chance of this, but just in case there's someone listening and they have no idea what you mean by technocracy.
Sure.
I think you started to explain it, but I wanted to make sure you were going to cover that
yeah.
just in case. What is technocracy?
Yeah, good question. We're going in that direction. It's
yeah.
necessary to bring it out.
Yeah.
Their own publication from 1938, called The Technocrats, a magazine the technocracy movement produced,
mm-hmm.
Defined technocracy like this, and this is a direct quote, "Technocracy is the science of social engineering,
mm.
the scientific operation of the entire social mechanism to produce and distribute goods and services to the entire population." That's a direct quote.
Wow.
Now, you can see scientific, mm-hmm. Science of social engineering. That we see that all over today. You
we
know,
sure
people,
do.
Science says this, science says that.
Yes.
Well, you should do whatever science says. Not Simon says, science says.
That's right.
And you can see the economic flavor in here. Their goal mm-hmm. was to produce and distribute goods and services to the entire population. It was literally a replacement economic system.
Yeah.
And it started out at Columbia for a number of reasons. It got kicked out of Columbia in late 1933. An organization, Technocracy Incorporated, was started, and it was it's still in existence today. Actually, not too many people following it, but that original organization promoted this economic system everywhere they went. They wanted Congress to just be dismissed. They wanted the president to declare himself dictator so that he could just implement technocracy outright. It's 100% totalitarian. Yes, it does. It's very totalitarian.
Yes.
Not communism or socialism.
Yes.
We'll talk about that later.
Yes.
But it was an insidious scheme that Americans ultimately rejected, mostly in the late 1930s. And especially one of the things that really worked against them is they had quite a bit of resemblance to National Socialism at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It might have been inadvertent or it might have been on purpose, but anyway, they got a kind of a bad image, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Some people that really didn't like Hitler, they said, I'm not mm-hmm. going to have anything to do with these people.
Right.
The movement was actually outlawed in Canada for 2 years during World War II.
Wow.
The Canadians went a little bit further than Americans mm-hmm. did. They said, you know what? You guys dress like the, you know, some of the Nazi people over there in Germany. And sometimes you talk like them, and we're just shutting you down. You're just you're out of business.
Yeah.
And they let them start back up again 2 years later.
Mm.
But there was some considerable angst going on at the time. But the technocrats, they lived on, and the philosophy lived on, probably at Columbia University, if nowhere else. And I believe a relatively young scholar back in 1968, who was teaching political science at Columbia University, I believe he discovered or started looking at very carefully historic technocracy.
Mm-hmm.
And he came out and wrote a book called Between Two Ages, America's Role in the Technotronic Era. And it was published in 1970. And that man's name was Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Mm.
He got together with David Rockefeller shortly thereafter that. I think Rockefeller saw the potential in what Brzezinski mm-hmm. was writing about
mm-hmm.
and said, you're coming with me, boy.
Yep.
You know, we're gonna make some tracks together. And yes, they did. They went to Europe and bounced the idea out off to all of the Bilderberg group over there, and they said, go for it, guys. We'll be right behind you.
Mm-hmm.
And so they came back and started the Trilateral Commission in 1973. With the specific intent of creating a new international economic order. That was all over their literature back in those days.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, it's interesting. So we have, just to kind of bring that forward, your question is about the United Nations.
Yes.
Here's what the head of climate change at the UN last year, she's since stepped away. Her name is Christiana Figueres. But she was the lady that orchestrated the big climate change convention in New York City for the UN last fall.
Mm-hmm.
And she said in the press conference a year and a half ago, this is a direct quote from her lips, she said, this is the first time in the history of mankind that we're setting ourselves the task of intentionally, within a defined period of time, to change the economic development model that has been reigning for at least 150 years since the Industrial Revolution. That's a direct quote.
Yeah.
Now, you don't have to read between the lines here. I don't think
I need
to explain this to anybody, what she's saying.
Yeah.
Capitalism and free enterprise
mm-hmm.
are out the door as far as the United Nations is concerned. And it's going to be replaced by sustainable development. That's what the mm-hmm. United Nations pushes, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's their whole thing, the sustainable development. They started circulating that term back in the mid-1980s, and in 1992, it really got its official start at the first Earth Charter Summit in Rio de Janeiro in 1992 that produced the Agenda 21 document that was the agenda for the 21st century. And sustainable development was the mantra of all of Agenda 21 and all that stuff surrounding that 1992 meeting. Well, the United Nations declared themselves in writing and vociferously in speeches and stuff their gratitude for the lady who wrote the book in 1987 called Our Common Future. She was the head of a task force that was appointed by the UN, and she got people together. They wrote this book. It was mostly her. It's called Our Common Future. It set the flag in the ground for sustainable development and all the stuff that was promoted in Agenda 21 in 1992. And they said if it weren't for Gro Harlem Brundtland, there would be no real conference. There would be no Agenda 21. They said it was her and all her, and hats off to her, you know.
Wow.
Well, Gro Harlem Brundtland was from Europe, but she was a member of the Trilateral Commission.
Mm.
This is not just incidental to the story.
That's right. That's right.
This was Trilateral Commission policy mm-hmm. that was hatched in the bowels of the Trilateral Commission, I would suggest, even years earlier. But you see, they just changed the name maybe to protect the guilty. instead of selling technocracy, a resource-based economic system, they sold sustainable development, a resource-based economic system.
Yes.
It's just the same system, different name on top of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's why I refuse to let go of the word technocracy. We must call it, this is nothing new. This is not new. This is old wine.
Yes, yeah,
and
that's right.
People need to know that. So that's why I continue to use it. In any case, the United Nations came up with this whole social justice stuff to redistribute wealth in the world. And people look at the UN and say, that's a communist organization. They're always wanting to redistribute wealth and stuff between rich countries and poor countries and, you know, the North and the South and whatever. They're constantly making trouble. I just want to make a distinction here, I think. When Brzezinski wrote his book, Between Two Ages, he wrote about Marxism quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But he basically concluded that Marxism was only a stepping stone to the final era, which he called the technotronic era.
Yes.
That would be technocracy.
Yes.
That would be a resource-based economic system, mm-hmm. like where we're headed today.
Yes.
But he said that Marxism was a necessary stepping stone to get there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It wasn't the end of it. It wasn't the purpose of Marxism, in his mind,
mm-hmm.
To just become a Marxist whatever, you know, communism or so global socialist state or whatever. That was never the intention.
Mm-hmm.
The intention was to use Marxism as that necessary stepping stone to deconstruct society.
Yes.
So that technocracy would be like the phoenix that rises up out of the ashes, if I'm making a good word picture here.
Oh, absolutely. I believe you are, Pat. And what you're describing reminds me of the Hegelian dialectic using the technocrats are using social justice just to move the marker. The social justice is not the ends. It's just a stepping stone to where they want to get. That's what you're saying, right?
That's right. It's getting them to their end. Their end is a resource-based economic system where they control all the resources.
Yes.
Now, this has never been done in history before. This is a global plan. This is not a regional plan.
Right.
This is global. And everywhere you look in the world today, resources are being gobbled up
mm-hmm.
at alarming rates.
Oh, yes.
And, oh, my gosh. I mean, look what's happening in America in the West here, like
yes.
the Bureau of Land Management, gobbling up land like there's no tomorrow. You've got the United Nations, or not the UN, the UN's going with them, but you have the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund going around to countries now that were put hopelessly in debt
mm-hmm.
by the same people.
That's right. Yeah.
These are the smaller countries of South America and Europe or Africa where there's untold resources, wealth and resources and stuff. They're going to these countries and they're saying, look, we're sorry that you're over your head in debt. You'll never get out of debt. We know that. You're probably going to suffer societal meltdown if you don't do anything about it. But we have a deal for you.
Should scare them to death.
We have a new program called Land for Debt Swaps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we'd like to swap your debt. In other words, we'll forgive your debt if you give us your resources.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What a deal.
And we'll just take that 100-square-mile strip over there and that 500-square-mile strip over there, and you're not using it anyway,
mm-hmm.
so you won't miss it, but this is a way for you to get out of debt. Mm-hmm. Countries are falling for this because they know if they don't get rid of the debt, they will be repossessed altogether. And their countries literally will melt down and break down. They'll have no food. All the politicians will be thrown out of the office or thrown out of windows.
Yeah.
And
Yeah.
You know, which has happened before, and I think they know that in South America.
Yep. Yeah. Yep.
You really tick the people off enough, you're gonna take a one-way trip to the basement.
Yes. Yeah.
So this is going on all over the planet right now, and through the auspices of the United Nations and many NGOs, non-governmental organizations that are working with the United Nations, countries are being twisted out of their resources, and it's getting locked up in what conceptually is the global common trust for resources.
Yeah.
And their idea is to put everything they can offline to humans, normal humans, and put it in the global trust that will be managed by global trustees. They never say who that's going to be, but I've got news. I know who it is.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a pretty good idea who those trustees are going to be.
Yeah.
And I don't think you're one of them.
Yeah. Pretty sure I'm not.
I know I'm not one of them either.
That's right.
But what that means for us is, let's say you're a businessman, just a run-of-the-mill business guy, and you had a couple, $3 million in cash, looking for something to do. And I don't know, let's say you... Say you drill oil wells, for instance, and you think, I'm pretty good at this stuff. I know where there is some oil. And so you go to the global trust and you say, you know, that little strip of ocean right off of Florida, whatever, I'm really sure there's big, I'd like to risk some money. My own money, of course, I'd like to go out and drill a couple of wells out there. And I think I hit pay dirt and I'll make a lot of money. And, you know, you're hoping that they would lease you that track of ocean for whatever, you know, a few hundred thousand dollars. And they would see you coming and they would bolt the door. Basically, you'd never get in. If you even could ask the question, we'd say, look, we don't know who you are. You're just a little pipsqueak. And, you know, we don't have anything for you. Get lost.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd come home and say, well, so much for that venture. You just would not break into that global trust of resources. You'd never see it. You'd never touch it. If you tried to get in illegally to do something, they would probably come after you with tanks, guns, ships, and whatever's necessary to protect it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were one of the global chosen few, like, say, BP.
Yes.
Or Exxon or whoever.
Mm-hmm.
And you wanted to drill some wells, why, here's where you send your money, Mr. President, you know, whatever. They said, yeah, we'd love to work with you. You're right up, you know, right on it, right on here.
Mm-hmm.
They'll see the resources, but you won't.
That's right. Yeah.
And that means that we're developing a two-class global society of the haves and the have-nots.
Mm.
There will be those business people who have exclusive access to those resources. Everybody else will be locked out, excluded completely from economic benefit.
Yes.
From those resources. And people say, well, that's preposterous. Let me tell you, there's a 25,000 square mile wilderness area in Idaho called the Frank Church Wilderness Area. It was just a boon for hikers and hunters and, you know, people that just like to go out and do stuff out in the wild. Well, they've introduced wolves and bears and other things and outlawed guns and stuff at the same time. It's not too friendly a place that you want to go.
No.
Maybe you could take your bow and arrow like the Indians used to do. But just, you know, a few years ago, they went and closed off all the roads. They locked the gates. They put gates across the roads. They locked them, put no trespassing sign, no ATVs allowed. And you will be prosecuted if we catch you on this property anymore. It was locked up, literally locked up. You can't even go out there and take a pine cone out of that area.
Well,
not legally.
I'm wondering, Patrick, what they're up to.
Well, this is the resource grab.
Yeah.
This is
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
They're grabbing the resources, taking it away from you and I, and putting it into a global common trust that will be accessed by these by the global elite who want it when they want it.
Yes.
All the rest of us will be excluded from it.
Yes.
And this is why Agenda 21, by the way, had a clause in it that you can buy that book on Amazon, by the way, if people are wondering, well, is that a myth? I heard that was a myth. No, go to Amazon, look it up, Agenda 21, buy it. It's about $40.
Mm-hmm.
You get your own copy.
Yep.
But there's a clause in the Agenda 21 book that says private property is going to be done away with altogether. That the selfish men, the citizens, don't have any need for private property.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can keep the clothes you have. You can keep your watch and your jewelry and, you know, personal belongings. But property outside of that, like, you mean larger assets like land and a business and stuff like that? That's right. Private property is on the chopping block altogether. It
mm-hmm.
has been since 1992.
Yeah.
And this is the agenda that the United Nations is pushing. Mm-hmm. Common people like you and me are being stripped of our property rights, slowly but surely.
Yeah.
People out west here that have had, like ranchers, that have had access to public land that they paid leases on for 100 years, not, you know, going back more than 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
This was their property. They owned this property. They're being kicked off by the Bureau of Land Management and other federal agencies, run off the land.
Yeah.
They're just run out of business. They mm-hmm. can't survive without that land.
Yeah.
Private property is being stripped away all over our nation and all over other nations around the world as well. And so you say, well, what happens to the private property? Okay, if your private property is taken away, if you have a 100-acre farm, and the government somehow, or maybe it's the Nature Conservancy, whatever, comes out and grabs your property, and all of a sudden it's not yours anymore, it's theirs. Once you lose it, no human will ever, nobody like you will ever get that property back.
Right.
You lose it, you lose it for good.
Yeah.
And that property will be held up in you know, for access to it will only be granted to those elites who say they want to have access to it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
But you'll never see it again.
Yeah.
This is happening all over America.
You mentioned, Patrick, that the UN is, of course, leading the charge globally in this. They are at the center. In fact, they could be seen more or less as the hub for this kind of activity. And you've got a statement in the article that I referenced earlier, The Pseudoethics of Social Justice, right from the UN's own website. It says this, and I'd like to read that, and then I have a question. From the UN's own website says this, quote, "For the United Nations, the pursuit of social justice for all is at the core of our global mission to promote development and human dignity." Now, I've got a lot of issues with that statement in itself, but I'm going to continue reading it so we can hear from you. just the things that are implied there are outrageous. But anyway, continue the quote. "The adoption by the International Labor Organization of the Declaration on Social Justice for a Fair Globalization is just one recent example of the UN system's commitment to social justice." Now, what in the world is the United Nations involving itself in the promotion of development and human dignity on a global scale? Isn't this just a cover for everything you've been talking about?
It is.
Yeah.
Every socialist, communist dictator in history has used the same kind of bait and switch. They say that social justice is good for society. Even if it's not good for you individually, it's good for society.
Yes. The so-called common
good.
And
that's right. And they'll use terms like human dignity. Well, you're not against human dignity, are you? How could you answer that? You know?
Right.
Well, yeah. I'm not for it. Well, you must be for social justice then, too. No, I'm not.
Right.
You know, around and around
mm-hmm.
you go. But this is the same thing. Adolf Hitler could have said something almost very similar. He could have said something like this. He could have said, for the German state, the pursuit of social justice for all is at the core of its global mission to promote development and human dignity for all German citizens. He could have said that. He probably did, for all I know. I mean, I could just hear it coming out of his mouth.
Something very similar.
Hear the same thing.
Sure.
I could hear the same thing coming out of Stalin's mouth and Lenin's mouth. You know, and all the rest of them. This is exactly the way they present it to the people. And enough people went along with it. Here's the scary thing. Enough people bought this lie that it ended up killing them.
Yeah. Yeah.
They never saw the danger in accepting this. But when the Bolshevik Revolution came to power, and this was basically the same premise they offered them, this is you're going to see. This is going to be great. We're building utopia here. And enough people like that were living in Alice in Wonderland said, "Oh goody, oh wonderful," and they went out and hugged the tree. They're just in La La Land, and they're walking like sheep to their own slaughter.
Well, I'm glad you used that metaphor, that picture there, Pat, because that's a good segue into social justice's religious expression. Now, the last time you and I chatted on the show, I think it was it's hard to believe, but I think it was early last September. It was just before Pope Francis's visit to New York City, and he addressed the United Nations, and he addressed Congress while he was here. And his agenda, well, that's a good way to put it. His agenda was Agenda 21. It was climate change, the greatest threat to mankind. And I can kind of understand how Pope Francis and even the Roman Catholic Church as an organization would get behind social justice. Because it originated within that body and as well as liberation theology and some other things. But and you touched on this earlier, but I want to explore this a little bit. How in the world do you explain the mindless, almost lemming-like quality of evangelical pastors falling in line behind this social justice mantra and blindly following along and leading their sheep to the slaughter? How in the world do we explain that?
Yeah, boy, I tell you, I scratched my head at that one too. I'll give you a little bit of a roundabout theory for some. This might explain some of it.
Okay.
Not all of it. I'm not going to say that. But when a pastor begins to dabble in practices like contemplative prayer, which is an ancient Catholic routine, very similar to Eastern mysticism practices, or, you know, meditation practices, where you sit down and empty your mind and you chant a mantra, even a verse from the Bible or something, or just say Jesus for 20 minutes. You empty your mind of all thoughts so that you can connect with God. And I say, as I'm saying this, people should recognize that is absolutely anti-biblical concept. There is no command in Scripture. There's a command in Scripture not, you know, to keep your mind full of things like the Word of God.
Yes.
And, you know, if you want to be transformed in your mind, well, it's done through the work of the Holy Spirit. It's done through the washing of the water of the Word as well. So we're never commanded to empty our minds. But listen, here's what I think happens to some of these people. When they start playing around with this stuff, this postmodern emerging church stuff, and it invariably leads to the practice of contemplative prayer. It's basically just Eastern meditation. When you empty your mind of all rational thoughts, including the Word of God, and you're sitting there just like a turnip at this point, I would suggest that anybody that wanted to make a little post-hypnotic suggestion to you would be quite successful.
Yeah.
And things like, you know, could just hear the whisper.
Social justice. Social justice.
With a hiss on the end. Yeah, that's right.
And all of a sudden, the guy thinks to himself, wow, I just had an experience with God. And, oh, man, I'm stoked. I just finally got this concept of social justice.
Yeah.
And away they go.
Yep.
And then they go read a few books by some of these famous emerging church pastors and stuff, you know, that have written books about this. And they see social justice. And they say, dang, I never saw this before, but now I see it. And I was blind, and now I see. And, wow, I'm going to start talking to my congregation about social justice.
Yes.
And we're going to go start getting together with the other churches in town.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to get together with the Catholics. And maybe we can find a mosque that will participate with us. And, maybe even the Baptist down the street would get involved, you know.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, they got, you know, they've taken a complete –
I
like it.
Yeah,
and like I'm talking to a pastor. I'm not telling you anything new.
Well,
look, you know what it is to be a pastor. Okay?
Yeah,
you've been a pastor. I don't know you personally yet, but I know enough about you. You've been a pastor. You care for the people in your church. I hope you do for everyone. And you were brought up in your Christian faith to be a pastor, one who shepherds God's flock.
Yes.
Jesus is the head shepherd. You answer to him, and the people in your care are to be shepherded just as he would shepherd them. And basically, in one sense, you're accountable to the Lord for how well you do.
Yeah.
But look, when all of these other emerging church practices come along, and people and theologies and ideas like that come along with Leadership Network and other organizations like that that are trying to turn the church into a business.
Yes.
What happens is the pastor, he walks in his church a pastor one day, right?
Mm-hmm.
He gets indoctrinated with this stuff. He gets and it has a few seminars with Leadership Network.
Mm-hmm.
He reads a few books or whatever by some of these emerging church pastors. He goes in his office one day, his pastor one day, and he's a pastor. 2 days later, he comes out the other door, and he's no longer a pastor. He looks the same. He's still dressed the same. He's no longer a pastor. He's a community organizer.
Yeah, and I...
Nobody knows. The problem is the people in the church, they see him next Sunday. Hey, Pastor Mike, how you doing? You know, it's... Well, they don't know. He got converted, if you will.
Yeah.
And he got turned into a community organizer, not a pastor anymore.
Yeah, and that parallels pretty close, Pat, to something that I've been chewing on, and I'll just throw it out there for our listeners, and especially for pastors that listen to the program. Pastors are referred to as shepherds in the scriptures for a reason. And God holds the shepherd accountable for the direction of the flock, for where they pasture. The shepherd is responsible to lead the flock to good pasturing grounds. And we see that repeatedly in the scriptures. But what happens today is too many pastors have become what Jesus warned about in the New Testament. They've become hirelings, and here's how that has happened. They've allowed themselves to become accountable to boards. They've taken their cue from the fellowship. So in other words, whatever comes in the door, whatever thinking from the secular world the sheep bring in with them begins to influence the entire flock, and pretty soon it influences the pastor to the degree that if he wants to maintain his job and security, he begins to talk about what they're interested in. Well, that's completely upside down, Pat. The pastor is supposed to lead the sheep. The pastor is supposed to determine the good pasturing fields. So what I'm saying is to my pastor friends that are listening, you must set the course for what the sheep are eating. And it's very easy. It's very simple. You simply stick to the scriptures. You reject anything that's outside of the scriptures. You reject anything, any of the latest fads. Pat, you've named several of them. The emergent church, contemplative spirituality. We could go on and on and on and on. So I guess I'll step down off my soapbox now, Pat.
I took a soapbox.
Just to say, pastors, you have a responsibility. And brothers or sisters, if you're a believer and you're in a church where the pastor starts talking about social justice, you need to run quickly. Find the first exit and get out of that place, because that's about to be a train wreck. And you need to find a place. I call it a remnant church. A remnant church is characterized by a pastor who just preaches the Word of God simply, directly, tells you what you need to do based on the Scripture. And you can check him out any Sunday. Is what he is saying from the pulpit true from the Scripture? It's very easy. So anyway, sorry to hijack that, Pat, but I just felt the unction to share that with our listeners. That, listen, social justice is poison for a church, and many evangelicals are drinking this poison.
They really are. And you know, the so-called ecumenical movement that's trying to bring the evangelical church back in line with the Catholic Church.
Yes.
The ecumenical movement is steeped with social justice language.
Yes.
And so when a pastor or a teacher begins to quote people like St. Loyola of Ignatius or the mm-hmm. Desert Fathers or mm-hmm. whoever, there's a bunch of them like that,
yeah.
That is your first telltale mm-hmm. sign that person is reading the wrong material. They're not reading the Bible like they should be and sticking to it. When you hear somebody starting to quote those people, that's a clue mm-hmm. for you to get your sneakers on and get in the starting position.
That's right.
Like you said.
That's right.
And then you're going to hear the buzzer, you know,
and you're off.
Yeah, you hightail it out of there. You know, you look like the Roadrunner. Yeah.
That's exactly right.
Get out of that place.
Get out of that place. Well, we've covered we've covered social justice from in an economic context. We've covered it in a religious context. Now I'd like to turn to the one that normally sends the most fireworks off, and especially in this heated, rather unusual, very strange election cycle that we find ourselves in. Social justice has a political context too, doesn't it?
It really does, and Hillary Clinton plays this card very well, taking from one group and giving to another group. It's
yes.
the same old stuff.
Mm-hmm.
If it hasn't occurred to any, by the way, it's not always just money. It can be other things as well. It can be dignity, like respect. You
yes.
say, well, that person gets respect. I don't get respect. You know,
yes.
think of Rodney Dangerfield.
Right.
I don't get no respect. And you demand to have respect from, you know, from people because that other person doesn't deserve it. It also has an application in knowledge as well. You know, for the people that have all the knowledge, why, you know, how do they get off having all that knowledge and you don't have that much? Well, that's not fair.
Right.
You know, you should have as much knowledge as they do. Listen, get a clue. Get a clue here. This was exactly what the devil said in the Garden of Eden.
Yes.
God has some secret knowledge. He hasn't told you. He's been hiding it, been building it up from you. He's got secret knowledge, and you deserve, sweetheart, to have mm-hmm. some of that knowledge. And, you know, he just doesn't have any right to hang on to that knowledge. You should go eat of this fruit.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Social justice is the devil's playground. It's the only play. I think it's the only playbook he has.
Yeah.
He's used it over and
sure
over
has.
And over.
Yeah.
And he's using it today. And in the
yes.
political, in any case, in the political arena here today, Hillary Clinton brings this off perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
She knows how to pit one group, you know, group A against, or group B against group A. She knows how to pit different groups at each other's throat. She's a master of it.
She is.
Of course, Barack Obama is a master of
mm-hmm.
it, too. He's done a very, good job. He's done a work on us, right?
Yeah.
On
yeah.
our nation.
A tremendously evil job.
That's right. And Hillary will continue that unquestionably. Then
yes.
the next question comes up, what about Donald Trump?
Mm-hmm.
How does he fit into this?
Mm-hmm.
Because he doesn't talk about social justice. He talks about, you know, earning stuff yourself or whatever. And mm-hmm. like, it's kind of a different pitch. You know what yeah. I'm saying? So the jury's still out on it, but yeah. I'm not saying I'm who I'm voting for at all. Believe me, I right. probably won't vote for Hillary, but I'm pretty disturbed with right. the whole scene right now, right?
Well, I've got a question for you, Pat. I thought about this for a while, and I've had people ask me this question, and I've given them a response. So I'm curious what your response is, because I've said for a very long time that that Trump's popularity and his support is due in large measure to Americans who are simply fed up with all these social justice cultists, whether it's Black Lives Matter, La Raza, or any other special interest agitation group. They're just fed up with it. And Trump right. is saying the right things. And my personal view is that's why he's got such an overwhelming support. And just as a side note, and then I'll shut up and let you take the floor, I think the media is lying through their teeth. I think Hillary is way behind Trump in the polls, and they just refuse to report that because they don't want to add any fuel to the fire for Trump. But anyway, what do you think, Pat?
Well, I think on the media, I think you're absolutely right. The media wouldn't tell the truth if it ran out and bit them.
Right.
They haven't for a long time. They're owned by all the same people that own Hillary. So
yep, that's right.
You know, why would you expect anything different?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, it's exactly what we're going to hear. As far as the man himself is concerned, the populist movement that is rising up, they don't know why they're rising up. They just
right.
know they're ticked off.
Yes.
You don't have to know where your pain comes from to feel the pain.
Mm-hmm.
Like you might have a kidney infection and your back hurts like crazy. Well, you may not know you have a kidney infection, but you understand you got a backache of mm-hmm. major proportion.
That's right.
So America's hurting, but doesn't know why. And it's reaching out for solutions and stuff, and Trump is saying all the right things.
Yes.
And,
yeah.
Almost maybe too many right things sometimes mm-hmm. for me.
Yeah.
But he is saying the right things. People are gravitating to that. I honestly don't think they're gravitating towards Trump himself.
Yeah.
I think it's really more of an expression that, you know what? He's saying the things that I wish I had said.
Yes. Yeah.
And
yeah.
I could see myself saying that same thing.
Yeah.
So they're identifying with him. I'm not sure that they like him as a person that much, but they like what he's saying.
Yeah.
Here's what bothers me a little bit about this. He has a lot of flavor of a technocrat. He's
mm-hmm.
Mr. Fix-It.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's not a constitutionalist, but he is saying, I can fix anything. He says, I can fix anything. I know the system, and I'm the only one that can fix it.
Yeah.
He said that.
Yeah.
So there is an element of Trump's candidacy that makes me a little bit nervous.
Mm-hmm.
And his likeness to the technocrat mindset gives me caution.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that gives me caution is I was alive when Jimmy Carter ran for office.
Yes, yeah.
Back in 1976. He was the first Trilateral Commission president.
That's right.
Brzezinski bragged later that he was the one who had actually picked Jimmy
mm-hmm.
Carter to be president.
That was in your
and
book.
He trained him.
That was in your book, wasn't it?
Was.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it
yeah.
was.
Yeah.
He trained him, and Carter claimed he was a guy from the outside, didn't know anybody in the Beltway. He was just a poor old, country boy farmer, peanut farmer from Georgia.
Right.
And he carried a big black Bible. He was a Baptist.
Mm-hmm.
You don't say Baptist, right? You say Baptist. It's like a B.
Right.
Baptist.
Baptist.
Yeah, that's what they say down south. I'm a Baptist.
Mm-hmm.
But he conned the Christian community
mm-hmm.
into thinking he was like, you know, wow, man, a born again Christian is mm-hmm. going to be president. And you know his campaign motto was like Trump has a motto, right? Let's make America great again.
Yeah.
His campaign motto was, I will never lie to you.
Mm, yeah.
That was it.
Yeah.
I will never lie to you. And
yep.
that's all he ever did. I think that was the first lie.
Yeah.
That he didn't really know how to tell the truth. He just didn't. He was just saying
mm-hmm.
whatever needed to come out of his mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And truth had nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
Whatever was expedient.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I watched that train wreck happen, and
mm-hmm.
he ended up being the all you can say is the predecessor to Barack Obama,
mm-hmm.
because until Obama came along, he was the worst president that we ever had in
mm-hmm.
our history.
Yeah,
and the most destructive, I might add.
Mm-hmm.
Horribly unconstitutional stuff he did. He gave away the Panama Canal, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Sovereign U.S. property. Imagine the president saying, imagine Obama saying, I'm going to give Florida to Cuba.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who would stand for that?
Right. Yeah, that's right. Oh. Yeah.
Well, that's what Carter did when he gave away the Panama Canal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, American boys sweat and got malaria and died building that stupid canal.
Mm-hmm.
And he just gave it away for nothing, practically.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. You know,
political points. Yeah.
Well, Jimmy Carter pulled off a major coup. He lied to people, and he knew what people wanted to hear. He said those things, and he got elected by a landslide. And so here we have again, call me skeptical. Okay, call me a cynic. Go ahead. But I'm a little bit skeptical that anybody can read a poll to find out what people want to hear.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Certain pastors have been good at that for a long time,
yes.
By the way.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, they go out and they say, what do people want to hear? That's what I'm going to tell
yes.
them so I can fill up the offering plate, you know?
That's a fact.
But that's a fact.
Yep.
But, you know, in the political realm, this is almost a joke in a sense because, yeah, okay, polls are everything to these people. They do focus groups. Mm-hmm. They go out and, you know, they interview people. They talk to people. And they, you know, they go to secret, you know, meetings and stuff secretly and just mm-hmm. listen. Anybody could figure out what needed to be said, including somebody like Donald Trump. Now, I don't want to be called a Trump basher, per se. I'm just throwing out some of my personal concerns.
Yeah.
And I realize we just wiped out both major candidates. And, you know, if that were the case,
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. We're going around, you know, my wife and I, you know, talk about, well, are you going to vote for Trump or not? I said, I don't know, man. I just don't know. Yeah. You know, I've got hesitation about it. You know, the only thing I do know, I wouldn't vote for Hillary on a bet.
Yeah.
You couldn't force me to do it. I would rather
right.
just die first.
Yes, right.
Vote for her.
Yep. Yep.
Oh, geez, I know.
I agree. Yeah.
Yeah.
You might as well just.
It's an interesting parade at this point to me.
It is.
Kind of like we're watching the Thanksgiving Day parade, you know, from the platform, and
mm-hmm.
we're commenting on each float that
mm-hmm.
goes by, right?
Yes, that's right.
And oh, look down, just turn in the corner down here is you know whatever you know it's last
yeah.
year's float from the Rose Bowl or whatever you know.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yep. Well, folks, I want to encourage you to get Patrick's book, Technocracy Rising, The Trojan Horse of Global Transformation. You won't be sorry you did. You get the book and read it, and I think you'll have your eyes opened up to exactly the game plan that's going on. And all these things that we've talked about, this is just scratching the surface. The United Nations is up to their eyebrows in all of this, the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Bilderberg Group, all of these groups. If you want to understand how they all connect together, you need to get Patrick's book, Technocracy Rising. That's available on Amazon. Can they get it from your website, Pat? Technocracy?
They sure can.
Okay. Technocracy.
Technocracy.news.
Yes.
They can buy it. There's a link there on the right. They can buy it there as well. And by all means, get on the mailing list.
Yes.
You get a daily digest of articles
yes.
that I post if there's something posted. Normally it's
yeah.
every day except
yes.
Sunday. I
yep.
take Sunday off. Thank
yep.
you very much.
Yep.
But,
yep. That
you'll
is
get
a,
an idea.
That's a great source, folks. I tell you, I had subscribed when Pat first put the website out there, made it available, and really it is a tremendous news feed source. I get a lot of my information on what's happening out there globally concerning our freedoms and liberties and those who are trying to take those away from us from technocracy.news. Go on the website and subscribe, get on the mailing list. Well, Pat, I appreciate you spending time with me again.
You bet. Let me just say one last thing,
sure.
and that is everybody should get their nose into Bible prophecy.
Yes.
Read the book of Revelation. Read it
yes.
every day for a month.
Yes.
And then go back and read the book of Daniel, then read Ezekiel, then read Isaiah, then whatever, you know, go through all the minor prophets. Get into Bible prophecy, and you will see just how close we are to the end. And, you know, as you look at any given story on technocracy.news, if you are really eager to understand Bible prophecy, you will have stuff, your eyeballs will pop out.
That's right.
About at least once a day, probably. That's something I post.
Yeah.
And you will be blessed because that's why it's called our blessed hope in the New Testament.
That's right.
We should talk about these things and we should understand so that we are not caught unaware when he finally comes.
Amen. And if you're interested in teachings on the book of Revelation, I'll give myself a plug here. Go out to the YouTube website, and you can subscribe to the Calvary Chapel of Lima YouTube channel. All my teachings through Revelation they're posted there, so you'll have your eyes open for sure. And I appreciate you bringing that up, Patrick. It's so important that we pay attention to what the Bible has to say about these days that we live in. And Patrick, you sure do a great job of alerting both believers and non-believers about what's happening in the world today. So I appreciate your work very much.
Well, thank you for your encouragement. I do appreciate that, too. Sometimes it's a lonely spot.
Mm. Yes.
But you know what? The Lord put me after it, and I'm not giving up.
Amen.
So, you know, just keep plugging on.
That's exactly right.
I was raised on a ranch, too. And I, you know, cowboys. Goal in life is to die with his boots on.
Yeah, that's right.
Preferably falling off his horse.
That's right. Which means you were working up to the last second.
That's right.
That's right. Amen. Well, check out Patrick's website, technocracy.news, and the book, Technocracy Rising, the Trojan Horse of Global Transformation, and you'll be glad you did. Pat, thanks for joining me again on Soaring Eagle Radio.
You're entirely welcome, Pastor Mike.
Soaring Eagle Radio is a production of Transforming Word Ministries and is released under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. You may subscribe to the show on iTunes, follow us on Facebook where you can discuss this episode, and follow Soaring Eagle Radio on Twitter at Soaring Eagle Rad, and listen to every episode from our website, www.soaringeagleradio.com. The opening audio montage collection was created by Micah 68 Productions. Visit them on the internet at www.mika68.com for more information. Friends, remember the Apostle Paul's admonition to the believers meeting in Rome. Therefore, I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. I'm your host, Mike Spaulding. Thank you for joining us today for this edition of Soaring Eagle Radio.
Thanks for tuning in today to the Soaring Eagle Radio program. For more information about the show, write us at Soaring Eagle Radio, 682 West Grand Avenue, Lima, Ohio, 45801. You may also contact Mike directly by email at the following address, PastorMike@woh.rr.com. God bless you today as you seek him.